2 years ago, researchers from Washington and St. Louis universities released a report looking at health care disparities between affluent and poor communities and the effect disparities have on communities. The study was titled For the Sake of All. It's been frequently cited on this program, especially the finding that people of some more affluent zip codes were living as many as 18 years longer than those in poor communities. The project was led by Dr. Jason Purnell of Washington University's Brown School. He joins me in studio. Great to see you once again, Dr. Purnell.
Great to be here, Don.
And congratulations to you for being the recipient of the Focus Leadership Award for 2016. Well-deserved for your work on the For Sake of All report.
Thank you very much.
Remind us once again, before we start our discussion, of the impact of the kind of disparities we're talking about.
Well, the impact is significant. As you said, we reported on that 18-year gap in life expectancy between 63106 in North City and 63105 in Clayton. I like to say that those aren't just statistics. Those are people's lives and lives that are being shortened because of differential access to the resources that support healthy and productive lives.
Right. And it's an issue certainly here, obviously, as our study has shown, but it's an issue all over the country, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We're dealing with the issue of really an unequal distribution of resources across major metropolitan areas. There was just a study that was released in the journal JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, looking at the geographic dispersion of life expectancy and how much shorter geographic areas with high concentrations of poverty people are living shorter lives.
And this is an issue. Is it an issue of poverty first and foremost or race first and foremost?
It's the interaction between the two. We know that poverty is not randomly distributed, and we know that really over a century of housing policy has gotten us to concentrated areas of poverty where we find more African-American poverty concentrated into these tight pockets where disadvantage just accumulates.
2 years out, I think it was May of 2014 that your report was issued. Is that correct?
Yes.
So it's two years ago. What has the impact of that report been? Is there something measurable here?
It's had quite a bit of an impact. First, in terms of informing the public and the public's understanding of these issues, that when we talk about health, we're not just talking about doctor's offices and ER rooms and hospitals, but we're talking about health happening, as the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation says, where we live, learn, work, and play, that there are multiple determinants, what we call social determinants of health, that are actually driving health outcomes. But it's also had an impact on our regional planning and our discussion. So For the Sake of All was a main source for the Ferguson Commission. And every Ferguson commissioner had a copy of that report the first day that they met. And you'll see reflected in their signature calls to action many of the recommendations of For the Sake of All. And I gave testimony in February of last year and consulted with the Ferguson Commission, and we're working now with Forward Through Ferguson on what it looks like to implement some of this work.
Well, that implementation is the key, and we talked in the previous segment, you may have heard it, but there's been a lot of discussion about things getting done, but not a whole lot has actually been done.
Well, I think it's going to take some time, but we're very optimistic about the work that we've been trying to lead in terms of implementation. So back in February, we convened about 100 stakeholders at Washington University, everyone from government to philanthropy to nonprofits to healthcare, many of the major healthcare institutions in St. Louis, around eight specific strategies, everything from universal child development accounts to school-based health clinics, to a mental health regional data system and an advocacy organization for inclusive and affordable housing. And each of those groups was led by a facilitator with BJC's Center for Clinical Excellence in developing some initial implementation plans. And we've had follow-up meetings, and we're seeing real traction in the areas of, in particular in the areas of school-based health and expanding the role of community health workers.
Why has health been the linchpin for this entire study?
largely because that was the area of expertise of the folks who came together to work on this issue. It was health, but it was health in a particular vein. It was health and its interactions with things like educational disparities and economic disparities and residential segregation and the quality of neighborhoods. So health really broadly understood.
But you associate it with one of the things that comes to mind immediately is school dropout rates, for instance. What does health have to do with that?
Well, actually, what people don't often recognize is that education is one of the strongest and most consistent predictors of health outcomes that we have. One of the things that we're finding at the national level is that people who have high school or less education, back to this notion of life expectancy, are falling behind in terms of life expectancy compared to those who have some college or more education. Mm-hmm. So education becomes this really strong predictor of your health and how long you can expect to live.
And what are some of the other areas in which that's the case?
Income, mm-hmm. Wealth, the quality of neighborhoods. We know that, for instance, the outcomes that children have are tightly associated with the socioeconomic status of their parents, even before they've set foot into a school building.
So one of the answers is greater access to health care, neighborhood health care, clinics, local clinics, that sort of thing.
Absolutely. That's part of it. But health care alone is not going to solve these gaps that we see in health outcomes. Yeah. And health care providers know that. They know, particularly those who are serving the most vulnerable populations, that there's a whole host of social and economic barriers that are standing in the way of people's health.
We're talking poverty. I mean, if we boil it down to its basis, that's what we're talking about.
We're talking about poverty, but everything that goes along with poverty, the disorganization and the disorder that happens in people's lives when there aren't adequate resources, when there aren't grocery stores, when there aren't safe places to play, when there isn't affordable and adequate housing. So it can't be boiled down simply to having a lack of economic resources. It's everything that goes with that.
One of the articles I've read recently, and I think it was in conjunction with your anticipated visit here, was the New York Times report saying that poor people tend to live longer in New York City than they do in other cities. And that surprised me. Did it surprise you?
Well, that was part of this study I was telling you that came out in JAMA. And we actually, a colleague of mine, Steve Wolf at Virginia Commonwealth University, and I wrote an editorial in JAMA that went along with that paper. That's the interesting finding of his paper, that those geographic areas, those cities that actually have more resources in general, that the poor do better in terms of life expectancy in those places.
They have more facilities. It's a wealthier community, and they have access to more services. Is that what we're talking about?
That could be potentially. Chetty and his colleagues aren't able to sort of dig down into explaining that association. Right now, it's a correlation that they found, but that's certainly a reasonable hypothesis that even though their incomes may be impoverished, this context that they live in provides sufficient resources that their life expectancy is better. Now, we have to hurry up and say after that their life expectancy is still lower than the affluent people who live in New York City.
But that's a clue. It seems to me it's a clue, and it's something that you can use. And when you're talking to the people you're talking to, hey, this seems to be happening in New York City. Why can't it happen here?
That's exactly it, actually, yeah. Don. Yeah. I mean, that's the crucial kind of central concept here. And we have this cultural and philosophical bent towards individuality in the United States. Yeah. And one of the things that I've said is that individual effort is necessary but not sufficient for successful life outcomes. You need a supportive context in order to have success.
You've had a number of community forums discussing For the Sake of All. And I know you have one more coming up. I believe it's the last one, number six of six.
Great. It is on June 27th.
Right. We'll put information about that on our website, by the way. But what have you learned in the previous five that, perhaps is giving you something that you hadn't seen or heard before?
I think the most hopeful thing about the forums that we've done, they've been organized around each of the six areas of recommendation. So we've had forums, we call them community action forums, around early childhood and school-based health care and mental health. We did the latest one at the Science Center back in April in partnership with the Alive and Well Initiative on behavioral health. The thing that is most hopeful to me is that, you know, we average about 150 people at each one of these events. There is energy. There is interest. There are people who want to know what they can do. And what we've tried to do with these events, we release with each one of these forums a discussion guide and an action toolkit. The discussion guide is so that people can continue to have these conversations in their networks of influence. And the action toolkit gives people concrete things that they can do to react to these realities in our region.
And who is showing up for these meetings?
It's a really diverse group of folks. We had people represented from 77 different zip codes at the last forum. We had over 200 people. We do find that it's predominantly women. Folks tend to be on the more educated end of the spectrum. But in terms of the racial composition, anywhere from 50% white to 40-50% African-Americans and others. So this is a diverse cross-section of the St. Louis region that's coming to these.
It sounds like exactly the kind of cross-section that you want and need to make any of this work.
Absolutely.
You mentioned mental health a moment ago. We did a program yesterday on that, and there were some disturbing things going on. One in five people suffer from some sort of a mental issue. How great a problem is that? And I mean great in terms of size, not anything else. Is that in a community like St. Louis?
It's a very serious problem. And that's another of those areas where our problems in St. Louis mirror the national problem. And it's primarily a problem of stigma and access. So there is still significant stigma around mental health and mental illness. And there is a lack of access to providers and clinical services for folks who are in need of that.
When we talk about a lack of access, you know, one of the things I'm thinking of that would be useful would be neighborhood clinics. It's one thing to go to the emergency room at Barnes or someplace. It's another thing to have someplace close by where you can go for just to meet basic needs. Is that on the agenda?
It is. And one of the things that we reported in the report was that we saw a significantly higher rate of inpatient hospitalization and use of the ER for African Americans for mental health conditions. 42% of hospital charges for mental health were for the treatment of African Americans, even though they make up 30% of St. Louis City and St. Louis County, which suggests to us inadequate access to community-based outpatient mental health services. But there are lots of complicating factors in terms of how you pay for that and then also how you get people to get over the stigma of accessing mental health treatment.
It seems to me kind of like a pay me now or pay me later kind of situation. The cost has to be enormous.
It's a significant cost. Yeah. Depression alone is costing us billions of dollars in terms of productivity, and that's just one disorder.
Yeah. Crime? Crime is an issue also that's very, very costly in so many ways.
Crime is incredibly costly. But we've got to do a better job of investing on the front end in these things. We know, for instance, that children who have access to high-quality early childhood programming are less likely to be involved in the criminal justice system. We know that people who graduate from high school are less likely to be involved in the criminal justice system. We know that two-thirds of people who are incarcerated have some sort of mental health problem, and we've transferred the burden from mental health institutions that were closed down in the 1970s and 80s to the criminal justice system and the corrections system and
that's
expect
right.
people to get better when we know that that's not realistic.
That's come up in every program we've done on mental health, that the jails and prisons have become warehouses for people who are mentally ill, which is absolutely the very worst thing
absolutely.
For them.
Yes.
You've also mentioned housing. Explain to me how housing works into this. We have a tweet from someone here saying current housing development practices in the city do not benefit those most in need. Is that where you're going with this?
Housing is one of the things that I've learned the most about since doing this work. And what I often tell folks, I was actually at a symposium on St. Louis that was held at Harvard's Graduate School of Design a couple of weeks ago. It was all about St. Louis. We've actually innovated segregation here in St. Louis, believe it or not. We had one of the first municipal ordinances in the country that was explicitly racial segregation. We innovated restrictive deed covenants where white homeowners would contractually covenant with one another not to sell their homes to African Americans.
And it was a St. Louis case, Shelley versus Kramer, that ended that practice back in the 40s.
It ended it, but that practice became codified in terms of what the FHA later did in the Roosevelt administration. So we have this history, and I can't commend more Richard Rothstein's The Making of Ferguson. If folks who are listening can get their hands on that essay, it lays out this history beautifully. What he argues is this didn't just fall out of the sky. This happened on purpose. This is a series of federal, state, and local policies that gave us a St. Louis that is the fifth most segregated metropolitan area in the country. And all of that means you think about all the things that are tied to housing. Education is tied to housing. The distance from your place of employment is tied to housing. The adequacy of transportation is tied to housing. But perhaps most insidious is this notion of wealth that a lot of people don't think about. Most Americans, the majority of wealth that they have is tied up in the value of their homes. When you segregate people and you don't allow those home values to increase, it's impossible for an entire segment of the population to accumulate adequate wealth that then gets passed on to children. I'm leaving here and going to a conference down at the St. Louis Federal Reserve Bank that's about this issue, where they found that college-educated blacks lost more wealth during the Great Recession than non-college-educated blacks. And there's still a considerable wealth gap between white and black households. Much of that has to do with failed housing policy over the last century.
That was a tremendous setback, wasn't it, 2008, when all of that happened, on so many levels, but housing certainly is a principle.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Right.
But it's this accumulation of disadvantage that most people don't appreciate. It's multiple generations. Very often when we talk about these issues, we look at snapshots or slices in time. We don't see the accumulated disadvantage of the inability to be part of the economic mainstream, to accumulate wealth, and then to pass that wealth on to the next generation.
Now, our previous guest, I don't know if you had a chance to hear, was talking about the history of this. Nothing new. This is not, you know, Ferguson showed us a lot, but it was nothing new what was going on in Ferguson.
It's not new. And what we have to do if we're going to be serious about addressing this is reverse engineer that century of policy. And it does have to be at the level of policy. We're not going to program our way out of this. We're not going to service our way out of this. We're not going to volunteer or donate our way out of this. We've got to change systems and structures and policies.
But as we also said in the earlier segment, the people who are poor, they have the least amount of political clout or capital to wage any kind of a fight.
Well, that's why we really need to begin to flex our civic muscles here in St. Louis. There are other metropolitan areas that have a far richer tradition of organizing and civic participation. You look at places like Chicago, where that is the case, where the president was doing much of his community organizing.
Sure.
And there are people in St. Louis who are beginning to think seriously about how do you build that civic infrastructure? How do you give people more voice in determining the policies and the practices for the region?
But it's still the fifth most racially polarized community in the country.
It is. And that has more than just health consequences. It makes it more difficult for people to reach across those boundaries and work together.
That's kind of what I was getting at. What's ahead? Again, you're 2 years out with your report. And I know you're having these community gatherings that you've had. Is there a follow-up? Is there a sequel to For the Sake of All? What's the plan?
I tell people the thought of putting out another one of those reports gives me a bit of heartburn. But the real focus going forward is going to be on implementation. It's going to be on, you know, successfully bringing together and being that neutral convener who can bring together stakeholders across sectors to begin to implement some of this work. And we're already seeing that happening. We met a couple of weeks ago with three of the major healthcare systems, several of the major school districts, and others to talk about how do we sustain the two school-based health clinics that we have at Roosevelt High School and Jennings High School and establish two more within the next 16 months. And people are serious about that, and we're going to get that done.
Well, keep us posted on getting that done. It's been a pleasure talking to you again and getting this update on For the Sake of All. Still a lot of work to be done, needless to say.
Thank you, Don.
Dr. Jason Purnell, thank you so much from Washington University's Brown School. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.